Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into the stories that the mainstream media doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time, but now I'm going after the Deep State. We are sitting in Miami, Florida, and just about 2 months ago, Governor Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, pushed through the Florida legislature a bill making it a criminal offense to criticize Israel. A criminal offense, obviously, clearly unconstitutional. So it'll have to work its way through the courts. But right now, it is a felony to criticize Israel. So I happened to be here about 4 weeks ago, and a woman just nearby the studio in Miami Beach wrote a Facebook post criticizing Israel on purpose. The very next day, police, did you post this this thing in Israel on Facebook criticizing Israel? She said, yes, I did. You're under arrest. Well, not only did the Florida legislature pass this ridiculous bill into law, Governor DeSantis didn't sign it right away. Instead, once it was passed, he flew to Israel, signed it in the presence of Benjamin Netanyahu, and then gave Netanyahu the pen as a souvenir. I'm confused as to what country I'm living in these days.
Yeah, it's almost like a humiliation ritual. I mean, Randy Fine was supportive of that as well. I mean, he helped pass the anti-Semitism laws. And it's the crazy thing is, if you were to say the things that he say about Muslims, about Jews, you would be in jail.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I'd be in jail. That's right.
How is that not the height of hypocrisy?
That's right.
Like, I don't understand it. And it's just, for some reason, it's being accepted. And I'm just tired of it, you know? I'm tired of tiptoeing around it.
You said something a minute ago that I want to explore. You said you believe Randy Fine is worried because of some of the positions that he's taken. They're not playing well right now in this election. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he sees, like, his comments. I mean, everybody hates him. He did the TMZ interview after I did. And you know what? They gave me a lot of shit on there, but I got to give them credit. They gave Randy a lot more, and they held his feet to the fire, and they did come with receipts. So I do have to give them a little credit for that. But I think his PR team was probably pretty, well, at least he was pretty heated with his PR team after that, I'm sure, because that was a rough interview. And since then, you know, he's gone on some softball interviews. But if you look at the I mean, he did Tim Pool's podcast, and they had to turn off the comment section. They literally had to turn it off because it was just roasting him. And then people were actually paying money to roast him because they made it the comment section monetized. And people hated him so much that they were paying the podcast to talk to him on air. And so I found that, like, I mean, that's pretty telling. So I think he understands. If this is a nationwide election, he would be smoked. The only thing that he has in his favor is the fact that, like, you know, 70% of his district is 55 years and older. And, you know, they got, you know, propagandized with this Israel's our greatest ally, like, blah, 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 blah. They still think it's like, oh, just right against the left. And if we get rid of these liberals, then we're going to be fine. And it's like, I get it. Like, the liberals are crazy. Their talking points are nuts.
Yeah.
You know? But I also look at it from a honest lens of, like, where is that coming from? That is coming from the Jewish media that's telling them these crazy things. And I know that's, like, another thing that, oh, my gosh, you can't say that. But, like, it's no secret who owns most of the media. And so, you know, I just think there has to be responsibility. I mean, you know, if Muslims owned the media and they were doing this, we would be going nuts.
Yeah.
But this message is not coming from Muslims. It's not coming from Christians. And so, you know, I'm just calling it out. And with respect to him being scared, you know, I just look at what he's saying. I mean, he never in a million years would have said that he was going to cut off funding to Israel, because he talks about Israel all the time. I mean, every post is either about Israel or him visiting this college to talk about anti-Semitism. It's either about Jewishness or Israel constantly. And I think people are tired of that, you know? Like, they're waking up to the fact that Jews are not victims. They're crushing it. They're overrepresented in everything. They're doing really good. And, you know, and not that, like, I'm like, oh, you know, these, you know, we got to get rid of these Jews or whatever. I'm just saying, like, they have to have some responsibility with this massive disproportionate amount of power that they have. And it's like, if you're wielding the power, you know, fine, then no problem, no criticism. But, you know, anybody that is in a position of power in America should be able to be criticized.
Totally agree. I happened to be in Germany the other day filming a documentary. And one of the things that I noticed was, the Germans still have this sense of national guilt because of the Second World War. Okay, deservedly so. They were monsters. But they have bent so far backward to try to atone for what they did in the Second World War that now they are blindly and completely pro-Israel. to the point where, like in Florida, in Germany, it is illegal to criticize Israel. You just cannot do it. They will prosecute you. And in fact, what they've ended up doing is they've gotten themselves in bed with the Israelis on genocide. Genocide in Gaza, an unfolding genocide in Iran. You know, what is it, 3,000 civilians have been, 30,000 civilians have been killed? Whatever it is, the number I'm unclear
on. No. We went in there to free them.
Right. Right.
A week later, we're going to bomb you into the Stone Age. Mm-hmm. But we came here to liberate you. We came here to free you. You know, don't mind us. We bomb children's schools, blow up your bridges, threaten to
First
nuke
day.
Your entire country, you know. But, like, we're
First
here
day.
To help you out. You know, just trust the plan.
You know, I tell this story all the time about the night before we attacked Iraq. I was the CIA director's note taker in the final principals committee meeting the night before we attacked Iraq. So it's chaired by the vice president. We've got Secretary of State Colin Powell, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, the Chairman and Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, a whole bunch of big muckety-mucks. And General Tommy Franks gave the order of battle briefing. That's how he started off the meeting. I'm sitting directly behind George Tenet, the CIA director. And General Franks finishes his briefing by saying his exact words, "If all goes as planned, we can be in Tehran by August." And George turns off his microphone, and he leans back and he says to me, "Did he say Tehran or did he say Baghdad?" And I said, "He said Tehran."
Yeah.
At the end of it, as we were getting up to leave the meeting, one of the guys from one of the senior directors at the National Security Council says, "As soon as we cross that border tomorrow, they're going to throw flowers at us." And I went back to I was working for the deputy director at the time. And he said, "How was the principals committee meeting?" And I said, "Did you know we were going to invade Iran?" And he said, "Are they still talking about that? We're not going to invade Iran." And I said, "Do these people know nothing about history?" And he said, "No, they know nothing about history." Here we are now, 23 years later, and the president of the United States was convinced easily, by all reports, that as soon as the first missile were to fly, the Iranian government would collapse like a house of cards. And anybody with any brains at all knew that was ridiculous, and that was a Netanyahu talking point going back to the 1990s. So now here we are, almost out of missiles, unable to protect two aircraft carrier strike forces, and no end in sight to this conflict.
But hey, week one, we won already.
Yeah, we won. We won like four times already.
Don't forget, we already won.
Somebody asked me the other day, how do you think this ends? I said, it ends when we wake up one morning and we look at Truth Social and the president said in the middle of the night, "It's all over, we won. Yeah. I'm bringing everybody home. We win." Big parade on Constitution Avenue. And sure enough, the next day, that's what he said for like the fourth time.
Yeah,
we won. It's over.
Doesn't say that at the gas pump, you know?
No, it does not.
And yeah, the strait's still closed. I just don't know how long people can be lied to before they open their eyes. I mean, they're going to feel it. They are feeling it, you know, and it's pretty obvious. And we, you know, I think he got dog-walked into that war. I don't think he wanted to go to war.
No, I don't think he did.
I don't think he had a choice, which is the scary part. Like, I don't think we have full sovereignty. And so that, to me, is the part that I think we really need to look into. It's like, why are we actually in this war? Because they even said so. The only reason we attacked is because Israel is going to attack, so we had to. Like, what is that? That is not a relationship of a country that we are providing a ton of aid to. Mm-hmm. Like, we should have a say in what they do. And it seems like it's the other way around. And I'm just looking at this like a completely one-sided relationship. I feel like we're like a battered wife. It's like,
yeah,
what are we doing?
Right.
You know, like, They keep screwing us over. They sell our secrets. They steal our uranium. Like, how many times can this country screw us over? And you were in the CIA. Like, I mean, what was your experience with Mossad agents? I mean, because I know it wasn't good. I've seen a little bit, but, you know, I want to hear it from the horse's mouth here.
Yeah, it was not good at all. Not only did we not like working with the Israeli Mossad, we didn't permit them in the building. It was literally the very first thing that I learned when I got to the agency. We do not brief Mossad in the building. They're not welcome here.
Stealing, bugging, right?
They would always come with gifts. Right? They come with a big seal of the CIA. First of all, they're everywhere. We don't need any more seals of the CIA, least of all one coming from the Israeli embassy. And it weighs three times what it should weigh because it's packed with batteries and listening devices. And we're like, guys, you got to stop doing this. And they laugh. Oh, all in good fun. No, it's not. You're trying to bug the conference room again. Yeah. So we have to, you know, rent office space. And we just meet with him in the office. I tell this story, too. The first liaison briefing I ever gave, I was only 6 weeks on the job, was to Mossad and Shin Bet. And so because I was the youngest, newest analyst, I went last. So the chief analyst starts first, then the political guy, the military guy, the oil guy, this guy, that guy, comes to me. And because I was overt at the time, I was not undercover, I used my true name. I said, I'm John Kiriakou. I'm here to brief you on, you know, X, Y, and Z. And the guy, the Mossad guy, has his glasses like this, and he says, spell your name? So I spell my name. And he goes, you are Jewish? And I said, I am not recruitable. Don't even think about it. I am not recruitable. I go back to the office. My boss said, how was it? I said, man, I am so mad right now. This guy practically cold pitched me right there in the office in front of everybody. And he laughs and he says, they've done that to every one of us. Every one of us in our first briefings with them. It's like they can't help themselves. And I've told this story many, many times that I had a colleague who went to Israel and was an overt employee. So the chief took him to Mossad and said, this is my guy. He's a CIA officer. His wife is going to work with you guys. He's going to go to the university and learn how to speak Arabic. Okay, so no problems, no threats, no nothing. The first time they went to dinner at the ambassador's house, they came back after the dinner, and all their living room furniture had been rearranged. Just as a message that we can do anything we want, and there's nothing you can do about it. So months later, they go to another dinner at the ambassador's residence. They come back to the house, and it's a family show. People had defecated in all of the toilets in their house and just left it unflushed.
Wow.
And then another year passes. They're getting ready to leave to come back to the States, and the ambassador has a going away party for them. They get back to the house. Someone had gone in the house, cut the dog's tail off, and then wrapped it in medical gauze and tape. And the dog is whimpering under the dining room table. And these are our best friends in the world, right?
That's crazy.
This is how they treat us. That's... And every time it happens, we have to go to the Mossad and say, stop harassing our people. And then they say, okay, okay. And they back off for a year, maybe two, and then the whole thing starts again.
Yeah, that's insane. I mean, how were you treated with other foreign countries, like even ones that we weren't allies with? I feel like it would be better than that.
Completely professionally. No problems at all. I literally never did I have a problem with a foreign intelligence service, ever, except the Israelis just cold pitching me right there in front of all my colleagues.
Yeah, I think that level of arrogance should tell you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And they know that there's no downside to it. They're not going to be punished in any way.
Yeah.
Not in any way. Nobody liked working with them. You just couldn't trust them.
What do people say when you tell that story? Because that's pretty compelling.
Well, it's funny. The people I know are interested, and they say, oh, my God, that's terrible. It's a shame. It's good that you're telling the story. People I don't know call me an anti-Semite, threaten me with death, call me a Jew hater. I got day before yesterday, I'm a Jew hater, apparently.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's actually, so on TMZ, he was going to switch over to Jew hater because I had issue with the term anti-Semite because I'm like, well, you know.
Well, the Arabs are Semites.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. So, like, Israel and, you know, and the Jews over there are actually the most anti-Semitic people, you know, on the planet because they're killing all the Semites, right? So I had issue with the term, and I think the term has been weaponized. So
100%.
I didn't want to be called that. And so the other host was like, okay, we'll just say Jew hater. And the main host, who was Jewish, was like, no. No, we're not losing this term. And it was like this, you saw this like battle in real time. And it's weird because, you know, the word anti-Semite has kind of been hijacked to mean Jew hater.
Boy,
so really,
it.
Like, that's, to me, when I think of anti-Semite, I think of Jew hater because that's what they've turned the word into. And the fact that he wouldn't accept that, which would be a more descriptive thing. I mean, that's, you know, basically what he wanted to call me, which isn't accurate because, I don't hate all Jews. I don't think that every Jew is responsible for all this stuff. And in fact, I have Jews that are friends. And so, it's like, Bobby Fischer, he was like 100% Jewish. And he said that Jews are like trying to ruin the world, And you got guys like Max Blumenthal that are calling this out. So it's like, it's not a complete monolith. I acknowledge that. But it's weird because they want to act like it's a monolith.
Yeah,
they want to treat it like, every Jew is a part of the tribe and is protected. And if you say one thing about this Jew, you're saying about all Jews. And if you say something about Israel, you're saying it about all Jews. So they're actually the ones that are pushing this narrative of a monolith. It's not us. It's like it's them because, the fact that they would coin that, any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic literally says that they are saying that if you criticize this country, you're criticizing all Jews. So it's weird. It's once again this hypocrisy of like they can say these things, but if you say it, you're an anti-Semite.
I went on the Piers Morgan show the other day. I've been something of a regular on that show, and I appeared with General Danny Ayalon, the former head of the Mossad, and Alan Dershowitz, who hates me, and Scott Horton, who's one of the great thinkers of our time, I believe, a great libertarian thinker. And it's just part of my personality that I don't interrupt people. I was always taught that that was just a rude thing to do. I generally don't interrupt. And that show's all about interrupting. So I just kind of sit there and let the rest of them go at it. And finally, Pierce says to me, well, let me ask John a couple of questions. John, do you think that Hamas is a terrorist group? And I said, well, I think that it is essentially a freedom-fighting group, but as it pertains to attacking civilians on October 7th, yes. If the point was to attack civilians, that's an act of terrorism. That's the definition of terrorism. And he says, do you believe that that it was a terrorist attack? I said, in part, it was a terrorist attack because it specifically targeted a music festival with the purpose of killing or injuring civilians for a political purpose. So yeah, that's the definition of a terrorist attack. He said, then what's your problem with Israel? And I said, Pierce, you cannot have as a policy to just kill everybody. That's not a policy. That's called genocide. There's a word for that. You cannot kill everybody.
Yeah, well, especially when they allowed that to happen and they funded Hamas and, we can go into all that.
And there were they funded Hamas, number one. And that's a proven fact. That was a policy decision taken by Benjamin Netanyahu. But number two, there were weeks full of intelligence indicating that an attack was coming. Mm-hmm. And Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's supposed to be the big mastermind of security in Israel and who's really just a war criminal, said
he's
no.
He's the worst, by the way.
The worst of the worst.
He's worse than Netanyahu.
Yeah, he is. He's worse. He's worse. But he insisted that the attack was coming in the West Bank. And I believe that the man is not that stupid. He knew it was coming in Gaza, and they were looking for something that would allow them to just kill everybody.
100%. And, it's shown in their response time. 6 hours to respond to that, and then when they do respond, they kill their own citizens, pump
exactly
up the numbers.
Right.
And so I'm glad that you didn't cave to that, because I think that what they try and do is establish a framework of like, okay, Hamas are terrorists. That makes them the bad guys.
Right.
So then Israel's the good guys, right? And they want to just make this very black and white. I'm glad that you didn't fall into that trap, because an easy one to fall into is just saying, oh, yes, I accept that Hamas is really bad. And it's like, look, maybe they did some bad things. I'm sure they did. I saw some things that they did which were bad. But like, if you really kind of look at it objectively, I think it was over 400 Palestinian civilians were killed in Gaza earlier that year. Right. And then if you look at the actual numbers of how many civilians were killed during October 7th, it's like under 400 mm-hmm. because you can't count people that are in the IDF or reserve IDF people.
No.
And then you also obviously can't count the people that Israel killed with their Hellfire right. missiles, shelling kibbutzes with the tanks. Mm-hmm. So when you really dig into it, it's like, was it actually that bad? Was it a response to what had already happened? Because if they killed less civilians than had been killed on their side, then is it a response? Is it a terrorist attack? I mean, obviously, it's bad to kill civilians. No two ways about that. But that didn't stop Israel from killing, you know, how many civilians, right? Like, we don't even have a count.
No.
I mean, some counts are up to 400,000. Like, I mean, the whole place is rubble. They bombed every single working hospital. They've bombed 90% of the schools. They bombed all the churches. It's like, you know, oh, Hamas was there. It's like, how many times have you got to hear that? And I don't even care if Hamas is there. That doesn't give you the right to, you know, blow up all the children's schools. It doesn't give you the right to blow up every single working hospital in the area. It's like, you know, and the example I would give is like, okay, you know, if your daughter or your son, they were in school and there's a school shooter, you know, unequivocally, hey, he's a bad guy. So what if they just blow up the whole fucking school? You know, they got the shooter. Like, is that an acceptable, you know, answer for you? Your daughter's dead, you know?
Right.
What are we talking about here? Yeah. So, I just don't, their whole narrative is just all nonsense when you actually dig into it, right? Because there's no beheaded babies, there's no babies, it's just all nonsense. And so, yeah, they try and frame it like that, and that's what I see is like a kind of like a stranglehold on history. And then what they do is they try and create this narrative that justifies their actions by accusing other people of things that they are either doing or have done after the fact.
Dan, one of the things that I think most observers of foreign policy have recognized over the years is that Israel thrives on regional chaos, right? Israel is safer when Iraq is in chaos. Israel is safer when Syria is in chaos, or Libya is in chaos, or now Iran is in chaos. What's the end game there? You can't have chaos all the time in perpetuity.
Well, I mean, if you accept their Greater Israel Project, and that's what they want to do, it's hard to steal land without distractions. It allows justifications. Mm-hmm. Also, turmoil in the region distracts from what they're doing to the Palestinians. They don't want peace. This idea that, like, oh, you know, just let the Jews have this piece of land and, you know, everybody's attacking. It's just nonsense. Like, they're constantly the aggressors. And so I look at this and I'm just like, I don't know of any other country other than us that has bombed seven different countries in a year, you know, other than Israel.
Yeah,
so it's like, I don't know. I don't think that they've ever wanted peace. They're a terrorist nation, and they're, you know, said this numerous times, founded by terrorists. I think that as long as we are supporting them and allowing them to commit all these terrorist acts, I mean, they're going to continue to be arrogant assholes. They're going to be, you know, everybody acts like, oh, well, it's the only democracy in the region. And I'm like, they are the only terrorists in the region. They're causing all these problems. And Americans just aren't, they're just not familiar with it. And so it's been framed to them that, you know, Muslims are bad. You know, Israel's good.
You know, that's another thing I don't understand, too. You're right about that. Americans are led to believe that, just as a blanket statement, Muslims are bad. I spent much of my adult life in the Middle East. And, you know, our relations, our foreign relations with almost all of the Middle Eastern countries are very, very tight, very close and good. You know, we have a so-called special relationship with the Saudis. Whether that's true or not, that's what it's called. Our relations with Kuwait are very strong. Bahrain is the headquarters of the Fifth Fleet. Qatar hosts the largest American Air Force base in the world. The UAE, I would argue that our relationship with the UAE is closer than it is with any of those other countries. The Omanis, we've turned to the Omanis for decades to be the middleman in our relations with, you know, the Iranians and with others. We're joined at the hip with the Egyptians, with the Moroccans, with the Tunisians. We have great relations. So how is it that somehow the Muslims always seem to be the bad guys, especially in American foreign policy? I don't understand.
You want the honest answer? I mean, it's Jewish propaganda. That's really what it is. I mean, it comes from Hollywood. It's because every time, you know, growing up, you see a terrorist, they're always Muslim. They always have, you know, a kiefer or, you know, whatever. And it's programming, man. Like, I was in the military. I did, you know, 3 months of boot camp. And in that 3 months, I changed dramatically. So what does 30 years of programming do to you? I always thought Muslims are a problem. I really did. Like, growing up, I was like, you know, especially when I was in the military, I'm like, oh, these Hajis, you know, blah, blah, blah. They have all these names for them.
Yeah.
Some of which I can't say on air.
Yeah.
You know, but they're bad, and it dehumanizes them, right? And so when you when guys come back from war, you know, guys that I went through, you know, training with, whatever, come back and, you know, talk and brag about, you know, these Muslims they killed. It's kind of like a badge of honor, and it's a way to justify the things that they did. And I really believe that a lot of the PTSD comes from coming back and realizing, like, maybe these weren't the bad guys, you know? And Rob O'Neill talked about that, actually. I heard him on one podcast where he kicked in the door of some guy's house, bedroom, whatever, and guy went for a gun and he shot him, and he was thinking about that. He's like, hey, what if, you know, what if that had been me? You know, what would I have done? I would have grabbed my gun and, you know, he would have shot me, and what if I had something in common with that guy, and what if we would have, you know, had a laugh over coffee and whatever. And it's like, would he have grabbed that gun if I didn't kick the door in of his bedroom, and why did I kick the door in his, you know what I mean? Like, you start asking yourself these questions. I mean, Muslims have always treated me with respect, and I'm sure there's bad ones, you know, and everybody wants to look at, like, oh, but the Muslim rape gangs in the UK and Europe and everything else. And that's, once again, it's kind of pushing this narrative. And it's like, yes, Muslims are for sure causing problems over there, but no different than the Mexicans coming across the border, and they're mostly Christian, you know, and the Ethiopians coming from Ethiopia, you know, they're mostly, I mean, Africa is mostly Christian. Right. And it's not because they believe in Jesus or they're, you know, came over with their Bible, they're causing problems. No, it's because they're poor and they're coming from a country that, you know, doesn't have strong culture. They have no affinity to the new, you know, country or state or wherever they're going into. And so that to me is the source of the problem. It's not because they read the Quran. You know, I've read parts of the Quran, and I mean, I've talked to a lot of Muslims, and rape is against, you know, their religion in any way, shape or form. So the only religion I've actually seen where rape is excused is in Judaism in the Talmud.
Thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember to always, always ask the questions that the government wants you to forget. This conversation was a perfect example of that. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.